This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm beside myself. Actually, I'm beside Rick Moranis right now. You may know him from his comic working places, from SCTV to Ghostbusters to the Honey, I Shrunk the Whatever movies. But he's here to talk about his wonderful, I'm using the word lovable for music CD, but the CD is The Agoraphobic Cowboy. Rick, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Basically, you sort of got to start thinking about this because of your kids, right?
Yeah, my kids, particularly my daughter, started listening to a lot of jam bands, Fish and Widespread Panic and String Cheese Incident, and then a lot of bluegrass, especially Yonder Mountain String Band.
And, oh, really? Okay.
And her boyfriend at the time was trying to learn how to play the mandolin. So there was all this bluegrass music in my house, which up until then had had a lot of classical and a lot of jazz playing. And when they were younger, I played them all kinds of stuff. Then I started hearing, coming off of her computer, stuff that I had played for her that she had forgotten, you know, like The Band and early Gordon Lightfoot and all kinds of stuff that I wanted them to hear when they were younger. And it just got into my head, and I started writing some songs just out of the blue. So on any given day, if I had a funny idea, instead of trying to write an op-ed piece, I'd try and write a song. And as I wrote them, I would call up friends and sing them over the phone and see how they were playing. And eventually, I had enough of them, and my friends started saying, you really should do something with this. So I did. And that's all that happened, really.
First of all, congratulations on the Grammy nomination.
Yeah, it's a real surprise. Very sweet, too. This is so great for Tony Shear and for Brian Camilio. Brian Camilio started a group called Artist Share here in New York, and it's primarily made up of jazz artists. So he's got all kinds of artists now, and they sell and finance their stuff over the web. In fact, he made history last year. One of his jazz artists, Maria Schneider, won a Grammy for the first ever recording not available in a record store. And I contacted Brian because I knew that this was not going to be the kind of music that I would be able to sell with a large label, nor did I necessarily want it to. I just wanted to do it kind of home-cooked. And I met Brian, and he introduced me to Tony Shear, who's a phenomenal musician, has a studio in his house in Brooklyn, is known for playing a lot of jazz with Bill Frisell and Sex Mob here in the city. He also plays a lot of rock on his own and played on a lot of the and produced early Nora Jones and Jesse Harris. He's into some great stuff. He's the sweetest guy, great guitar player. And he heard the songs and he said, let's record these. So we did over the course of a few months in his house on his little 8-track analog tape machine.
You're talking about doing some early scratch tracks of those, and you talk about there's a real airy sound to those. It actually sort of reminds me of a lot of the country songs of the late 60s and early 70s before they moved into sort of bigger, heavier production. And I sort of like the roominess of the tune.
It's all analog recorded. We were able to do it within the 8 tracks, and it has that warm kind of sound. I mean, I always envisioned that I wanted it to sound like the bus had pulled over and the guys that had been playing together for 30 years just recorded one day. And we kind of got that in a real nice way. And it has that very special warm sound that you get out of that kind of thing. And, you know, this is the ground floor of a house in Brooklyn, so.
Well, the other great thing about it, too, though, is it has that kind of – you talked about guys who play together a lot. It's that kind of offhandedness of guys who sound like they play together a lot, who sound like they enjoy the sound of playing together.
Yeah, and Tony believes in that, and he likes to leave mistakes in. He likes the personality that comes with live playing. And, you know, he doesn't like drum machines. He likes real drummers. So it's that style. And it lent itself to a country arrangement because it's kind of how the songs were written, and it's sort of also how he heard them.
I've got to tell you, my favorite song is Bonus Track.
Oh, yeah, mine too, actually. And it's a straight song. I mean, there's nothing funny in the song. It's just a straight-ahead homage to Train songs. And the impetus for it was I just wanted to see if I could write a song called Bonus Track. I sort of toyed around for a while with an idea about some guy on Wall Street trying to working towards the end of the year for his bonus. And I didn't like that. And I had this melody kicking around in my head that was sort of like a Gordon Lightfoot-style thing, but in a ballad form. And I thought maybe I could put two ideas together so I sped up the tempo a little bit and researched some old Train songs and built that song around that. And it was the last thing we recorded with the drummer. Tony turned to me and he said, so you got anything else? And I said, well, there's this one thing that I finished that I forgot to, you know, that I haven't played for you yet. And I grabbed a guitar and I played it for him. And he turned to the drummer and he said, let's do that now. And we did it. And he's so intuitive and so smart that without even thinking about it, he left more time on the intro of that than I think on any of the other songs. He also, I said to him, do you want to have an instrumental? He said, no, I think it should just come into the station and just leave. And he called me a couple of weeks after that and he said, hey, man, come on out to Brooklyn. I put a guitar track on it that I want you to hear. And he put that really sweet. I think it's beautiful what he did on that with a guitar. So I love the guy. He's so, so gifted.
No, because the great thing about that song is you don't know what you're going to get when you see that title in the first place. But it's actually slightly sort of elegiac, which I think is really kind of touching.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm hoping to collect the residuals off other people's bonus tracks.
Which is it's the treatment. I'm talking to Rick Moranis. You can get his CD, The Agoraphobic Cowboy. Where do they get it, Rick?
Well, for now, it's at my website, rickmoranis.com. How's that for an original website? Or at ArtistShare. And possibly soon to be in stores. You know?
See, I guess I was looking for, of course, to hear you say, maybe I just like to play my music to turn on pretty girls like you.
Right. The Clay Collins line. Eugene Levy wrote that line.
Oh, did he? Oh,
sure. He wrote the days of the week. He wrote the whole thing.
Well, because so many of the characters you play in the SCTV, I mean to digress for a minute, but so many of those characters were involved with music. I mean, I think of the great Michael McDonald sketch, the part of Jerry Todd with Michael McDonald.
Yeah.
But there, a lot of things you did on the show touched on music anyway.
Yeah, growing up in Toronto in the 60s, we all got into music. You know, I've said several times that we put down our hockey sticks and picked up guitars. And we all had bands and we were all lousy except for one person who became Geddy Lee, the lead singer of Rush. The rest of us stunk. When I first started doing stand-up comedy, I used my guitar in my act, and I used to do these sort of unrelated little bits, some songs, some halves of songs, just some little pieces of things, and I just always incorporated music into it. And when I got to SCTV, I did a lot of musical bits, a lot of Dave used to love doing those KTEL-style commercials, and we did a couple of those. I think I did Gordon Lightfoot Sings Every Song Ever Written. And we did the Jerry Todd thing. And, yeah, I used to love to play with that. And Catherine used to love to do a lot of music, too. So we always had good stuff to do together.
I think about them, and Dave talked about this when he's here, but one of my favorite things ever on the show, and it was finally one of these box sets, was when Tony Bennett comes and sings on the set just for you guys. That's so wonderful.
Yeah, and the McKenzie Brothers. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was surreal, actually, to be sitting there in Parkas and Tukes playing those characters with Tony Bennett. But we were on network by that point, and we were starting to get musical guest stars, and we were out of Edmonton and starting to get into the real world, and the real world of people that we had been previously parodying. So it was taking on proportions that none of us were really prepared for.
Yeah, you've gone from having Joe Flaherty play Tony Bennett.
Exactly.
To having Tony Bennett.
The real Tony Bennett.
But what was so great about that tune, it actually made me think about, I thought about that as listening to the CD, is just that sense of intimacy that you had with Tony Bennett on the set with you guys. But also, clearly, with Agoraphobic Cowboy, you're trying to create that kind of sense of intimacy that I think of growing up in Detroit and watching a lot of Canadian TV. There are lots of sort of singer-songwriter shows. Ian and Sylvia had a show. There are all kinds of people who just played music. That sort of sense of being in the room with people playing, which I really get from this CD.
I wonder how you get that, whether it's just the vocal style of being intimate as opposed to being back from the microphone and belting, or whether it's in the writing or the arrangement. I really don't know. On the other hand, in the same way that I don't consider myself an actor and just performed the material that I wrote, and that's how I became a performer, it was the best way to get the material that I wrote out. I don't really consider myself a singer. This was the best way to get this material out. And if I'm going to sing, it's to get the most out of my range, which it should probably be more intimate in its delivery. I think that's how I get to it as opposed to any intellectual forethought.
We're talking to Rick Moranis about his CD, The Agoraphobic Cowboy, which is available at rickmoranis.com. I'll keep plugging this for as many times as I have to because I think it's great. But you're talking about Phish and Jam Band, and those guys, they're playing to an audience to communicate to them, but it's more like with this, you're sort of playing in a way people need to sort of lean in and pay attention, possibly because I almost think about if there was a character who had written those songs, he would be somebody who has completely unselfconscious about whatever it is he's saying in the songs, like in press pause. I mean, just a guy who will say whatever it is, whatever emotional state he's in at the time, he just expresses that in those songs.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the reason why I knew that I didn't want to go a traditional route with this and go to a record company initially or anything like that. I knew that at the end of that Wheaties Box song, I wanted to go into an operatic ending, and I didn't want somebody to say to me, no, you can't do that because the audience won't like that, because I don't like working like that. And there's a difference between people often ask, you know, what was the difference between SCTV and Saturday Night Live? And one of the things that was different was that when you're not writing for a live audience, when you're not looking to make that communication, when you're only internally working with other people of like minds, and we had some great writers and we had that incredible cast, it means that instead of writing for the audience specifically, you're just writing for the room. You're just looking for the reaction from the people you might respect more than anyone. And the result is you neither pander to the you never talk down to the audience because you're not talking to the audience. And it's only when there's a live audience there that you have to start worrying, well, will they think it's funny? Now, I come to do this thing, and I'm playing these songs for Tony, and I have so much respect for him, and I've already sang them to a few friends that I really respect on the phone, so I've gotten the feedback that I need, just similar to the feedback in the writing room of SCTV, so now I'll go and do them. And I have no stake in it. It doesn't matter. There's no record company that's worried about it. I just go and do it. And if it connects, it connects, and if it doesn't, it doesn't, just like on SCTV. We had no idea we had an audience. We were on a 12:30 at night. We were working in Edmonton. We had no clue. We were just sort of making each other laugh. And it's different when you are trying to connect with an audience because then you have to think about that as an element in the writing. In the case of comedy performance, it's an element in the blocking. It's in the rehearsing. It's in the timing. You got to leave a room for the laugh. You got to do all those things. And I think that dictates a lot of the style of the material that we see in live performances and live shows versus studio productions.
Sure. Well, one of the friends you played some of this music for, I guess, is Donald Fagen, right?
Yeah, yeah. Donald was in the middle of writing, I think, the album that's coming out soon. And I call him up and go, can I sing you another one? He goes, yeah, I could use a laugh. That'd be great. Please, please. He's very fastidious, as everyone knows. So yeah, he was really supportive and really encouraged me a lot. And my friend Paul Perlov, who I still maintain is the funniest person I know, most people don't know him because he's a writer and a more of a producer than an on-camera performer. But people often say, who's the funniest person you've ever worked with? And I've worked with a lot of great people, from John Cleese and, of course, Steve Martin and all the SCTV people. I've been really lucky. I've had great partners like Kenny Finkelman in Toronto and Dave Thomas. But Perlov is absolutely the funniest person in the world. And was the inspiration for a couple of these songs, too.
Which of the songs?
Well, just coming out of conversations that we would have just about different things. And there'd be a phrase and I'd say, I think I'm going to grab that. I think I can do something with that. So he was involved in this, too, encouraging me a lot.
And also, too, it's funny we're talking about Donald Fagen because there's a lot of storytelling in these songs, isn't there? We get a sense of who this person is talking or singing these songs.
That's the thing about country. You know, there aren't too many genres where you can do that kind of thing. Certainly there's Broadway and off-Broadway show tunes. And there's some opera that you hear stuff like that in.
Sure.
And country is just a great place for that. But that's what I grew up listening to and still remember listening to Ray Stevens in the 60s with those crossover hits. Mr. Businessman, and I remember when he did the cover version of Misty with a banjo. It just blew my mind. Do you remember that?
Absolutely. We should take a break. We'll talk more about this. My guest is Rick Moranis. We're talking about his CD, The Agoraphobic Cowboy. I just like saying it. I'm Ellis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Shake it,
don't break it. You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. My guest is musician, songwriter, singer, Rick Moranis. You may know him best for his comic work in film and television, but his CD is The Agoraphobic Cowboy. And I'm glad you brought up Ray Stevens because it really, that sort of shift and his fearlessness about going from these sort of goofy comic things to something like Misty, which is a big sentimental turn on and sort of embracing the sentimentality of that song, is kind of wonderful. And just the kind of range that this CD has really sort of indicates that kind of fearlessness I'm talking about.
Yeah, and the line between parody and what you can do straight is very thin. To do a country version of Misty, how far is that from doing sort of a lounge singer version of a rock song? And then you have Paul Anka coming out with a whole album of it. You know, Bill Murray used to do that lounge singer, and I did the stuff on Jerry Todd as a Tom Monroe character. I did a police song and stuff like that.
Turning Japanese.
So much fun to do that stuff, and yet it's exactly what Paul Anka is doing straight. So there's such a fine line in that stuff.
I have to ask you this, since you bring this up. Were you sort of determined to sort of keep an ironic distance in the songs as you were performing them, or were you aware of that at all, or what? I mean, just sort of detaching yourself a little bit and singing them as you, or just getting into the head of the character who had written those songs and immersing yourself.
That's a good question, and that's the reason that it's not being done as a character, that I put my name on it.
Okay.
I ultimately didn't put a photograph on the album because I didn't want to put a visual image on it. And since it came out, I've had people from the country world ask absolutely no question about it at all. They totally get it. They just totally get it because it's in that sort of spirit that they understand, coming out of a long, long lineage of Ray Stevens and Johnny Cash and Roger Miller and all of those guys. In the vanilla world, it was like, well, where's the hats and the boots and the shirt with the sequins on, with the stuff on it? Because you're a comedian and you're doing country, you have to be parodying it. But I'm not parodying it. So instead of doing it as a character, I did it as myself. And I just sang them as myself, more or less. I mean, there are different sounds on the album depending on the song. And there are different narrators, I guess one could say, depending on the writing of the song. But it all comes from the same place. It's me.
I guess I wondered that too, because I wonder what point of view informed those songs as you were writing them, where that came from for you as you were coming up with them.
I don't know. I think, okay. You know, you sort of get up in the morning and you paint, and sometimes you know what you're doing and sometimes you don't. And in many cases, it would just come from a concept or a turn of phrase. In the case of Bonus Track, which you mentioned, it was just, I wonder if I could write a song called Bonus Track. And next thing you know, it starts playing around, and subconscious sometimes takes over, and sometimes you got to go to the thesaurus. And, you know, I mean, it's writing.
Well, Give Me the News is that's an amazing song.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad you like that.
I mean, just because it really is Gave Me the Business, not Give Me the News. I mean, just this, the way you find a way to sort of use the play with the chorus.
And that's pure country, because that's sort of what the classic country song will do, is take that metaphor, take that hook and just go with it and go the distance with it and have fun with the wordplay. And originally it was recorded in that tempo and in that key. And it sounded a little bit more folksy. And then one day I get a call from Brooklyn. Hey, man, I put a guitar track on Gimme the News. You should come out. I think you got to redo the vocal. So I drove out to Brooklyn, and Tony, the night before, had gotten out the electric guitar and put that rockabilly guitar on it. And I redid the vocal and pushed the vocal much harder, because up until then, it was a much lighter treatment, and it really lent itself to it. I mean, the guy's just really smart. He reheard the song and knew that it needed that, because here's this guy saying, come on, give me it. Give me the news.
Sure. Yeah. You got to commit to that in that way, or else it becomes ironic instead of being a song about an actual kind of a feeling, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the good thing was that it led to more use of that electric guitar and took the album in a slightly different direction after that. So he worked very intuitively, and I'm so used to second guessing myself and working with comedians that have to second guess themselves, because you're always really worried about, will it work, will it not work in comedy. In music, I don't know, maybe it's different. This is new to me, but he would get an idea and he'd go for it. He was willing to admit when something was wrong, and he would try things again. But once he made a decision, he was happy with it.
Well, congratulations on your Grammy nomination, Rick Moranis, about his CD, The Agoraphobic Cowboy. But I keep thinking about all the music I associate you with, like Little Shop of Horrors, for example.
Now, that's a great score. That, I mean, Howard Ashman, the late Howard Ashman, unfortunately, was a brilliant, brilliant lyric writer. What he went on to do in Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. But I think Little Shop of Horrors is his best. And
actually, a lot of those songs sort of had the emotional tenets of country music songs, really expressive about emotional points of view and sort of unashamed about what's going on. I mean, you can perceive them as slightly silly, but as with Give Me the News, you've got to sell those songs, or else they become just pure jokes.
Well, they really come from the same place. You know, you go see the movie Walk the Line, and you can see Elvis is in the car with Johnny Cash and with Jerry Lee, and rock went one way and country went another way, but it all came from the same place. That Little Shop of Horrors score, it comes right out of the sensibility of 50s rock and roll. And the stuff that we did on this album comes right from the sensibility of the country that grew out of that. So it really is on the same page. It's just sort of the arrangements are different.
Hearing it, I've got to think you've got to know exactly what sort of tone you want. And that's why I was talking about that sense of intimacy that it has, because that's so clear and so specific about it.
Again, I think the intimacy comes from a commitment to a certain kind of vocal style and vocal performance, and therefore a key that something is written in.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the rest of it, the commitment to record on 8 tracks and to write in that genre and to limit how much scope there will be to the thing, to not have a choir behind you and not have a string orchestra behind you and not be on a Pro Tool setup where you can pick an instrument and do samples and add whatever you want. The commitment to stay with acoustic instruments will lead to that kind of tone you're talking about, I think.
Talking to Rick Moranis about the Agoraphobic Cowboy, his new CD, which is on rickmoranis.com. What does your daughter think about it?
She likes it a lot. My son loves it, and my daughter likes it a lot and is liking it more all the time. She didn't love 5-star motels, and I don't blame her. I mean, she wasn't thrilled that I was writing about I give her credit for that, actually.
Dad, I don't want to know that about you. Don't,
yeah,
please.
Don't tell me about all your exploits. It's an apology, too, for my past, I guess.
It's really like a country music song, that song is.
In what way?
That's sort of, you know what? I'm just going to say this, and I'm not embarrassed. In that same tradition of—
You sound like Tony. I said to Tony after we finished recording, and I said, do you want to put a background vocal or a harmony line on it? He said, no, I think the guy should just say this. He should just say it alone. I don't want to have anything to do with this.
But there's that kind of— It's interesting. And the reason I said character is that I wonder how much of these songs are actually you and how much has come from someplace else.
I think it's the same as, you know, being on the subway one day, going down a writing room at Second City when we were doing the show and just coming up with an idea for a sketch that comes from a character, comes from a particular voice. I guess these are closer to me because ultimately in the performance it is me. But the actual writing of them, depending on the song, come from not a character, but from either a state of mind or a sensibility or an idea or a memory of an occurrence, whatever it might be.
Well, I guess the recent SCTV releases, Christmas with SCTV, with the SCTV Christmas staff Christmas party, which you must have some memories of.
Yeah, I remember actually the Christmas I remember is not – I don't know if it's on there. There was one Christmas where everybody wanted to get home and everybody was overworked. And Dave was a head writer, of course, and the responsibility of one more show fell on Dave. And there was nobody in the shop to build anything. The show had to be shot in limbo, basically, no sets. And the show that came out of it was a Doorway to Hell wraparound themed show. And most of it took place walking through fog and black because there was nobody in the construction shop. Everybody had gone home for Christmas. It was just Dave and me left, I think. And John stuck around. John Candy stuck around for a shoot. And anyway, I remember one day laughing so hard because the whole theme of the show was hell. And Dave was exhausted. And we were in a room writing together. And he just did about a 20-minute improv just for me, like a private concert. It was his Bob Hope, which there's nothing like in the world. Dave Thomas's Bob Hope. Hope in Hell. And the idea for the sketch was, you don't have a hope in hell. And he just did 20 minutes of Bob Hope in Hell. And it was hilarious. I don't know if it's on this Christmas CD. I doubt it. Or if that Doorway to Hell stuff is. I certainly know that the improv isn't because I wasn't running any tape on it. I wish I had it, though.
Is it hard for you to look back at those since they've been coming out so regularly now? Do you look at them at all? Do you show them to your kids or?
When the first ones came out, I showed them to my kids. I was surprised to see how much held up and how much didn't. You know, at the time, I think it's the way that we would edit now would be very different. I think we'd be tighter script editors and tighter on the floor and ultimately in post-production. I think comedy's come to another place too. But I think what was there, the fundamentals of what was there still holds. And it's, you know, it's hard for my kids to, in some cases, to watch me do that stuff because it's 30 years ago. And for them, their sensibility is so different, and comedy has come a long way. And even though it wasn't necessarily a topical show, we were very much in the time. We were dealing with the images and the characters that were in our world at that time. So there isn't a lot of it that holds up for a young audience. For me, you know, it was a couple of years of just such wonderful excitement and such a great time and working with the best people that I could imagine. I couldn't believe it sometimes that I was doing it. It was so exciting.
Do you feel like you have another album in you?
I've written some more material, but I don't know if I'm going to record it yet. I don't know. I didn't plan this one, and I'm not really planning the next one. The last couple things I've written have been jazz tunes because I'd love to try a couple of big band jazz tunes. I'm so tempted because Maria Schneider's on Artishare as well, and she does a big band thing, and I wrote a song, and I gave her the lyrics to it, and she loved them, and I really want to do something with her. But that's
is that going to happen?
I don't know. It's very expensive to get a big band.
For people who live in New York, every once in a while that band plays here, and it's amazing to see them play.
She's one of the only people doing that, and she's incredible.
And they're beautiful. I mean, it's just sort of amazing. This kind of weird sort of thing between Michelle Legrand and Duke Ellington is what she does. It's really kind of extraordinary. And if you're writing something, you'd go with something like that.
I hope. I mean, I hope. You know, the thing that I wrote is much – I think it's a lot more gimmicky than her stuff is inspired. I mean, her stuff is beautiful and so original. This is in the same way that my songs sound very derivative in some cases of country music, very familiar of country music that you might have heard before. I don't think I'm breaking any ground melodically in there. Although bonus track, I'm proud of actually.
Yes,
that's a good melody. The jazz song that I wrote that I hope to do with Maria is a pretty standard form, but the lyrics are fun and interesting. So I'd love to do that. And I've written a couple of other country things, but I don't know what's going
to
happen.
Do you feel like you're ready to sing some jazz stuff? Because that's a different kind of thing.
I'd love to try it. I would love to. But I'm totally open to anybody else singing my stuff. I mean, Tony wound up singing two or three of my songs at one of his shows, and that was really wonderful, flattering for me.
Are you going to go on? You mentioned the possibility of maybe doing some of the stuff live. Has this been talking doing a few shows here in New York? Or
well, I got a call from CMT, from Country Music Television, and they want to see if there's something we can do together, including they do this shoot on their website called – or this little thing on their website called Studio 330 Sessions, which is I think three or four songs that they do and very, very simply shot in a studio. And I think they want to try that with us.
You must want to, finally, having – live with these songs for a while now, just sort of try them out in front of an audience and see how it feels a little bit, don't you?
I did one live performance on NPR, actually, on WNYC called – there's the show called Soundcheck.
Soundcheck, yeah.
And Tony came and met me there, and we did two songs. And I was surprised. I liked it way, way too much. I mean, I really had a good time. So I'm anxious to try it again, but – you know, I don't see myself going on any big tour or anything like that.
Well, we're out of time. So in the interim, I can only suggest to people that they get a copy of The Agoraphobic Cowboy at – where do they get this from?
For now, at my website.
Which is?
RickMoranis.com or ArtistShare.com.
Okay, Rick, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Our technical director in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz with assistance from Lashik Wojcik at Carnegie Recording Studios in New York. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents. Hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.